Welcome back to Download here on WGN Radio. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 8:30, we are going to start our coverage of the Republican National Convention. Chris Roebling and Charles Lipson will be back, and we will bring you the speech, the Donald Trump speech, live here on 720 WGN. But first, earlier this month, a select group of music lovers were given a rare treat. Less than 100 people crowded into a Boston studio to hear a special reunion of the 80s college rock trio, Blake Babies. The Blake Babies hit the Boston music scene alongside bands like the Lemonheads and the Pixies, just to name a few. They had much success, and unlike many young bands of its time, broke up shortly thereafter. I say way too early. But this band is one that seemed to grow a bigger fan base after the breakup. This in large part to the alternative rock explosion of the early 90s, and because those fans were introduced to band members' new projects. The trio, of course, consists of guitarist John Strom, drummer Frieda Love Smith, and bass player and vocalist Juliana Hatfield. Juliana put out solo records and had mainstream success with the Juliana Hatfield 3, and John and Frieda played in the band Antenna. Since then, the influential rock band went their own way. Hatfield continues a tour and just recently started up the three again, and is in a project with the Replacements' Paul Westerberg's, the I Don't Cares. Frieda Love Smith is living in Evanston, writing and teaching at Northwestern. You may remember that she was on our program, this program right here, with her memoir slash cookbook, Red Velvet Underground, which just came out. And John Strom is now a Nashville-based entertainment lawyer. The group is back together for a time. They've launched a new Pledge Music campaign around a vinyl release of the Earwig demos. Earwig was the Blake Babies' 1988 album released by Mammoth Records. And they're playing a special intimate show Saturday afternoon at Space in Evanston. Doors open at 1 o'clock. The Blake Babies were formed in 1986. That's 30 years ago.
We're old.
30th anniversary. In studio with me tonight, Frieda Love Smith, John Strom, Juliana Hatfield, Blake Babies. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks. Nice to be here. This is Juliana, by the way.
There we go. We've
got
it.
This is Frieda.
This is John.
All right. So let's talk about the. I mean, John, why don't we start with you? I mean, I'm interested in how this kind of came about, the idea of the demos. They've sort of been dusted off from a basement shelf somewhere.
Right. Well, I came into possession of the 2-inch tape and without really realizing it. And I had a bunch of 2-inch, you know, these are the master tapes for albums you used to make back then when people recorded on tape. It's like a big box, that 2-inch tape. So my friend Paul Mahern, who was one of the producers of the Blake Babies, he did the Rosie Jack World EP, called me up and said they're shutting down their storage facilities, a nice climate-controlled storage facility in Bloomington, and he wanted to know what I wanted him to do with all these tapes.
And maybe so a couch. You know, he was,
right, so he was coming to Nashville, so he brought me just a trunk full of tapes and just dropped them off of my porch. And most of them were what I expected them to be. There were a couple of Antenna albums and some of my solo stuff. And then there was this one reel of Blake Babies that I had no idea what it was. And I opened it up, and it's a 24-track tape, and we'd recorded three sets of 8 tracks on the tape. So it was kind of a jumbled mess. And I took it to a friend to bounce to digital and then to another friend to mix. And when we finally got it cleaned up and mixed, it was really, really good. You know, we all listened to it and said, this is actually great. We should do something with it.
Were you surprised by that? I mean, you're surprised that they held up after almost 28 years, Frieda?
Definitely surprised, and surprised that it seemed like something we might actually want to share with people, because you don't make demos with that intention
right.
at all. But this it sounded like it really represented the band during a period of time that's not that well documented, and it held up surprisingly well.
Yeah, I guess this is pre-internet.
Well, exactly, yeah.
When you hear that recording you just played, that was the album that resulted, and that was a song we wrote later, so that wasn't on the demos. But basically what we did is we went in with our brand new producer, Gary Smith, who's a brilliant guy, and he was, you know, it was really a great break for the band. And he brought us into the studio and just set up mics and had us play our set. And then he used that as a production tool. He listened to that, and we listened to it together, and we made changes and produced the record, which, you know, if for people who aren't familiar with the process, the producer of a record is much like the director of a film. He got very involved, went to our practices, changed things, and, you know, we wrote new parts. But that recording is how we sounded in a club at that time, presented really well, recorded by the same guy that recorded the first Radiohead album, you know, a brilliant engineer. So it's a really cool memento.
Juliana, do you, I mean, when John said, hey, I got these tapes, we should do something with it, what was your first response to the idea of these demos being unearthed and brought to the public?
I think my brain just sort of shut down. I really had a strange, like, mental and emotional block about it. Like, I just sort of thought, like, okay, whatever, yeah, do it. I can't deal with this. Like, I couldn't.
That's
at
okay.
first,
yes.
I couldn't go there. I couldn't just go back and listen right away, just because I thought it would be too hard to hear stuff that I hadn't heard in that long, just because it was such a long time ago, and we were so young, and I thought I would be mortified by it. But
mortified because you would be embarrassed by the skill of it, or the emotional experience of the time, or bringing you back to that time.
But my own sort of insecurities, worrying that my voice sounded really high and too earnest, worrying that it was going to be so over earnest and embarrassing and just like too raw.
You're more exposed than we are because they're your songs or your lyrics for the most part, and you're the singer, so it's your voice, so it's maybe a little more intense for you to go back.
Yeah, and as you guys know, I was kind of a miserable person back then. I had a lot of emotional problems. I wasn't easy to be around. I was kind of miserable, but I think listening back to everything now, I'm actually not at all embarrassed. I'm really proud of it all, and I think that we did really good work, and we worked really hard in it. And I was just saying that that stuff, it really doesn't sound dated. I don't think you can hear the 80s in it.
Right.
I think it really still holds up.
It's 28 years old.
We were trying very hard to create something fresh and new. That was the goal, is we wanted to not be influenced and not do anything that was tried or cliched. And we weren't trying to be mainstream. Mainstream music then, we thought, basically was mostly awful.
Well, what would be the mainstream equivalent of Blake Babies at that time? I mean, obviously R.E.M. comes to mind, but that was even before.
They weren't mainstream.
They weren't mainstream at that point. So what do you even compare that to, the idea of ambition to be mainstream in 1988 when you're putting
mainstream? I don't think there is anything.
Because
we were just immersed in this scene it wasn't even a scene. It was just like everyone was kind of doing their own thing, and people were coming out, these original sounds were coming out of people. In Boston, there was, where we were based, there was, you know, like Dinosaur Jr., the Lemonheads, the Pixies, Throwing Muses. They all sounded really different, you know? So, and then the stuff we liked, I think the three of us listened to some of the same stuff, like we all liked R.E.M. and The Replacements.
Yeah.
And X. But then we also had really different tastes in some ways. So I think that when we got together, it was just this mishmash of what was around us and the different things that we liked and the similar things that we liked. So it was really, I think there was no model that we were basing ourselves on. We were trying to create, like John said, we were trying to create our own sound.
Julian, go ahead.
Well, the mainstream then was, if you wanted for context, it was like hair metal and
right,
and
yeah.
Absolutely,
or Paula Abdul, stuff like that, and that's what, you know,
you weren't trying to be Paula Abdul too.
Well, you can't really strive for that, and there was a strange moment where when we started getting courted by major labels around 1990, when Sunburn came out, or maybe before Sunburn came out, there was this strange sort of disconnect because. Like, we worked with one guy who produced the Bangles, and you know, he thought that what we were doing was very consistent with that, and you know, that sounded strange to me, at least. And,
John Strom, Frida Love Smith, Juliana Hatfield, Blake Babies in studio. They have the re-release, or not re-release, but the release of the demos of Earwig, their 1988 record. We'll continue the conversation here. We'll take a quick break. So good.
So good.
That's fresh, man.
That's fresh. What comes to mind, John, when you hear this song? I mean, this is, I mean, what comes to mind to all of you when you hear this music, you know, music that was produced in the late 80s, and you guys have obviously, you know, spent a lot of time away from this stuff.
I get weird sense memories. You know, I remember what it was like sitting in the studio and stuff like that. I mean, it triggers all kinds of stuff. So it's impossible for me to have any distance from it.
Yeah.
I think we were so driven, or I was personally, just so driven, you know, so believing in what we were doing. Did you guys believe in it as as I did?
We cared.
We believed
so much.
In it. We cared. And then that I can't imagine caring about anything ever again.
Well, I mean, this was, you know, you guys met. It's a famous story of meeting in Boston when you guys were all going to the Berklee School or around the Berklee School there.
Juliana and I were. Frida was just stealing food from the cafeteria.
That's close enough. That's
close enough.
Yeah. But you know, the story as we talked about it, Frida, and I've read, is that you guys wanted to work with Juliana, and she walked through the lobby, and you walked up to her dorm room, and you knocked on the door and said, "I wanted to start a band with you." Yeah, is that true?
Yeah, Frida can tell this one because this was really her deal. I mean, I was up for it and along with it, but it was definitely her deal.
Yeah, I just said, like, we're just going to go knock on her door and we're going to ask her to start a band with us. And she seemed to receive it really calmly and positively.
I think I was waiting for them. I mean, I went to Berklee because I transferred from Boston University because I really wanted to be in a band, and I was so shy, and I didn't know how to get a band together, and I didn't know how to meet people. And so the fact that you were eating in cafeteria makes up for the fact that I was on the meal plan, but I never ate in the cafeteria.
So it all balances out.
I was too shy to go to the cafeteria to eat.
Omelets. I ate your food.
Yeah.
But so what was I saying?
Well, the idea you were waiting for them.
Yeah, I went to Berklee to start a band, but I was too shy to go and meet anyone. So, I mean, I went to my classes, but then I was like, how do people start bands? And I'll just wait and they'll come to me. And then they did. It was kind of like a fantasy.
Yeah, well, we played destiny. That night. We went back to – Frida had an apartment down the street, and we had instruments, and we just immediately started playing. And Juliana started playing her songs, like, here are some songs I have.
I was ready and waiting for
the
band to come.
We had songs. We're like, okay, it's done. It took us about three years to figure out that we didn't need a fourth person. You know? We kept trying to have bass players.
Well, yeah. I mean, for you, I mean, when did it go from, this is great, I want to start a band. A band is sort of novel. That's why I'm at this school. That's why I want to be a part, to sort of the idea, the ambition of having a career in music, because Blake Babies took off. It wasn't something that, okay, it was fun to play at the club and it was fun to do your classes and then maybe do something on the weekend, but it turned into something where you guys were dedicated to it.
We were dedicated, but it didn't really take off in the way that you sound like you're meaning it. I mean, I remember a lot of struggling, you know, taking the number one bus down Mass Ave to Albany Street, and then we have to walk like another mile to get to this unheated practice space, like carrying my bass for a mile on this dangerous street down to the practice space that was unheated and freezing in the winter. And we had this like really dangerous. It had a really dangerous like propane heater that shot fire out of it.
Yeah, we should have all died.
There was not a lot of romance there. Now, the thing that kind of baffles me actually is that if you look at like what we were doing, what we were all intent on doing, you know, Frida and I together and Juliana separately, was we wanted to make a band and we wanted to be like the Replacements or something. We wanted to get in a van and go play joints, you know, and make records and put them on independent labels, which was not a career path. I mean, that was not a path to, you know, having a livelihood. And because the biggest you could possibly get, you might get to be in a bus and get hotel rooms. You know, you weren't you know, sort of able to be a millionaire doing that. And that didn't bother us at all, I don't think. I mean,
we never had a tour bus. We didn't ever, the Blake Babies didn't really make money back then.
No, we didn't make much money.
We all worked jobs, we made barely enough. But then, you know, I think what got confusing and one of the reasons why we stopped was because the business changed very quickly, and it pivoted on Nirvana's success, you know, around that time. And well, in the Pixies, I mean, there was a path to it, but it went from being underground music was strictly underground to being, you know, it was commerce. It was, you know, it was big
major label
showbiz.
Kind of stuff,
yeah. And that was, I think, hard to process. Sure. And that was around the time the band was getting kind of successful.
Chicago has this lore of an early 90s explosion when it comes to bands like the Smashing Pumpkins.
It's very real here. Yeah.
Right,
but it was the kind of thing that I've always wondered this about other cities. In Boston, in the time, let's say late 80s, when you're talking about bands like Throwing Muses or Pixies or Blake Babies, Lemonheads, was it the same kind of thing where the music industry came around, sniffing around to sort of bring bands out of that scene because that scene was so popular?
I think it was maybe a little different in Boston. It seemed like some of those bands got really big in England, like
Because of 4AD.
Yeah, 4AD signed them up, and then they were huge in overseas, but that never happened with us. And I think I don't know what I was going to say, but I feel like, I think that a lot of those bands kind of had blew up more than we did in
That's
terms
my
of
perception too.
Their followings and their critical respect. We were sort of the forgotten little child.
Yeah, I felt they
something.
Left us. Come on,
we did fine, you guys. No, there was a great. People liked us. They came to our shows.
Come on.
No, it was.
They were cool. And
here was the thing. In that time, 1988 in Boston. Yeah. Yes, I mean you go down the list. You got Buffalo Tom. You got the Pixies. You got Throwing Muses, Lemonheads, on and on.
Morphine.
All these, Morphine, Big Dipper. You've got all these amazing bands. And none of them were really popular yet. There was a moment where I remember we played at the Rat, which is about a 200 capacity club. Us, Throwing Muses, and the Pixies in the same bill, and it was about a third full, and that was totally normal.
Yeah, right,
it was an
amazing show, but
there was a guy from Melody Maker from England out there, so it was who wrote about it. So it was starting to percolate, but I mean, people didn't care about those bands, but we knew they were great, you know, because we're all music fans, we all had ears, so we're kind of pinching ourselves saying, this is amazing, these bands should all be huge. And then you kind of went to bed one night and woke up the next day and they all were, you know, and that was definitely disorienting, but very cool.
But it didn't start that way. I don't remember if we all went, but Dinosaur Jr., when they started out, they were called Dinosaur. And the first album, it just says Dinosaur on it. And the reprints all have Dinosaur Jr., but we went to see them at this place called Green Street Station in Jamaica Plain, and there were like 12 people in the audience, but they were still the best rock band in the world, and Jay was like the best guitar player in the world, and they had their thing totally together in front of 12 people, and it was like, it blew my mind, and the fact that there were 12 people in the audience didn't matter. We knew that this was like the greatest band in the world, or I did.
Totally. Well, it didn't. Yeah, you're not like, oh, it must not be happening. There's nobody here. I'll tell you who was there. It was us. It was Beat Happening, you know, Calvin Johnson, who were staying at our place at that time.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And it was the Screaming Trees, who were opening, you know.
That was the audience.
You know, sort of, that was, and there were about four barflies kind of hanging around. That was the whole thing, you know.
That's great.
It's incredible,
this is where we're kind of having the official history lesson of the Blake Babies. Here on the download tonight, John Strom, Frieda Love Smith, Juliana Hatfield in studio. We're talking about the release of their Earwig demos. There's a Pledge Music campaign to release those to fans, and they're also doing a Saturday afternoon show, very intimate show at Space in Evanston coming up this Saturday. We'll continue the conversation. We'll take a break for the news. We'll come back. Blake Babies in studio. Stay with us.
We'll be right back.
I try to keep it on as long as I can. It brings back such great memories. Blake Babies in studio tonight. John Strom, Frida Love Smith, Juliana Hatfield. Again, with like this song, I mean, is it a same kind of thing? It takes you back to studio. What is when you hear this music, when you hear Blake Babies, what is the emotional response? For Frida, what's the emotional response to you in that song?
Well, it's interesting you should ask me for this song, because this is the one that I mentioned to these guys a couple of times when I was relearning the songs to prepare for these shows. This one really moved me. I actually cried real tears when I was listening to it, and trying to kind of figure out why. And I think it's because it's really passionate and it's really sincere and it's really young in a way that has choked me up and kind of revisiting. But I also like the song, and I don't feel at all like embarrassed or uncomfortable about it either. Like, I really like it.
The funny thing about this song, though, is that it's, well, the way that we used to write songs, and you know, I mean, the way that we wrote songs when we did God Bless, and if we write songs in the future, the way we'll probably write songs is I write, you know, Juliana might write the whole thing, but sometimes I write the music and just hand it to Juliana to finish. And that's the way we wrote this one. So I had the whole piece of music and gave it to her, and she wrote melody and lyrics. I was very happy with the result. But the funny thing is that we did not have fans at this point. You know, this is before we had a record out.
That's true.
Nobody cared about the Blake Babies when we made this song. And she's like pledging to the fans that we're not going to sell out to them. We're going to be true to our, you know, sound and integrity and all
it's
that.
It's so optimistic.
Yeah, just to nobody.
Juliana, when you hear that song, what do you think? I mean, is there an emotional response to it?
Well, kind of. I kind of feel the way Frida feels. I get a little choked up just because we were so earnest and we were so young and we had such hopes and ambitions and we thought that what we were doing was really important and that it was going to set the world on fire, or at least I thought so, that I thought that, you know, this band was going to be really important. And but there's also part of me just here's the technical things. I think about, you know, the sound of my voice and the melody and the guitar sounds, you know, the jang, so jangly. So, I have a rush of thoughts when I hear it. Thoughts.
Well, I mean, you guys as musicians, because you've had other projects. I mean, we've been talking in the break about, I mean, obviously you guys have all sort of touched the Lemonheads at one point. You know, talk about the
never touched.
Yeah,
them.
I mean, well, God has, but the don't have touched Lemonheads. But Antenna, the Julian Hatfield 3. Do you see Blake Babies as? Are you able to in your career kind of sort of take it out and almost make that like a chapter in your life, and you're sort of be able to put it in a box, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I mean, yes, it was kind of. It was definitely a period of time, a very intense period of time, but then again, it's hard to believe that it was only a few years that we were together.
I know,
because it was such a major part of my life and my development and my young womanhood. I still feel it's still so vivid to me, all of it, and so. When listening to this stuff, it just like comes right, trying to relearn it comes right back to me, like the muscle memory is still there. And so it's like, I don't know if I answered your question.
No, but that's right. 1986 to 1990, right? That's
yeah,
really
91. We made 91.
They were like
5 years
eventful and I guess more than that, like heightened kind of time period. Like 4 years is really nothing to me now, but it was everything.
Yeah, it seemed like a really long time. It was really intense 4 years, I think.
Well, for me, from my own experience, because I play music now just for fun. It's a hobby. It's been a long time since I've been pursuing any kind of professional music. And you know, the bands that we had after the Blake Babies, Antenna, Villa Deluxe, those bands. I'm proud of the work we did. I'm proud of the records I made on my own. But I don't think that they were as artistically successful as what we did in the Blake Babies. In Blake Babies, I should say. That's the name.
Get rid of that.
And then in the Lemonheads, I was really just a player. You know, I played drums for a couple years early on. I played guitar for a few years later. But, you know, it was really Evan's band. So, you know, for me, for what I created during my quote unquote career, it was, you know, this is really the kind of the heart of it.
You know, Juliana, you've said a couple times now, you look back on it and you think about that time, you think about the skill involved. Let me ask you a pretty direct question. What did you learn from being in the Blake Babies?
I learned a lot working with Gary Smith, the producer, just about what producing is, and you know, learning how to ways to get sounds and record. And he did some things that I thought were weird, like at certain points, like separating the cymbals from the rest of the drums, like having you he had you play some without playing the cymbals and then overdubbing the cymbals, which was kind of interesting. But it's like just learning about and ways to layer things. And I learned a lot about bass from Evan. After our original bass player left, Evan Dando filled in on bass with us for a while. Mm-hmm. And this was before I knew how to play bass, and I think that he was one of my earliest influences as a bass player, just watching him play. And he was very melodic bass player, played kind of like a guitar player. And now I can't remember the question, but
whatever you want to say about Evan, and he's all of our dear friend. He's a genius. That guy's an amazing musician.
Yeah, he's a great talent.
It's unbelievable music that's been put out. And you know, I mean, Shame About Ray, which was the record that Juliana you were on.
Yeah, I've
been on a lot of stuff, but
it.
I mean, that really was an album that just crossed over. I mean, and in a way that I thought did it without MTV. And I know MTV played a big role in all this stuff, and there were videos and all that kind of stuff. But it really felt like that record was just one that anyone who was thirsting for alternative music at the time that maybe wasn't as hard and grungy as what you were getting on the West Coast found that Lemonheads record and just attached to it.
Yeah, it was so good. And Evan was just all about, he was just like a true music lover and a music scholar, and just like he has so much information about bands, and he knows a lot about music.
Yeah,
he's really good
at it.
Knows
a lot of stuff.
I forget what I was going to say.
Well, and he just like absorbed his influences in a way like nobody else that I've ever known.
Yeah, and such a great voice. And it wasn't for him, and what he had at a certain point after he signed with Atlantic, he was sort of seen as some kind of pinup by certain people, mm-hmm. like a dumb blonde pretty boy, which wasn't him at all, and that wasn't his doing, you know, like that. He wasn't that at all. He was all about the music, really, and you know, the lifestyle.
like girls. Well, it was a really weird moment there because the Blake Babies broke up, and you know, and Juliana's career immediately took off, and Evan's career immediately took off in an even bigger way. So, you know, there was a strange moment where, you know, we're back in Indiana, and those two are on the covers of magazines and stuff. And it was very generous of Evan to bring me back into the band for a while because I got to experience that. And I think it helps me to do what I do now that I got to experience being in a huge rock band, you know, which I wouldn't have gotten to do without his generosity.
John Strom, Frida Love Smith, Juliana Hatfield, Blake Babies. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll talk about the limited stuff that you're doing now, the show that you have at Space coming up on Saturday afternoon, and the release of the Earwig demos. Blake Babies in studio. Stay with us.
Get hot in the summertime. I get her out, there's nothing else to do. There's nothing on TV.
It's so hard to fade down on these songs.
I'll get rid of that one.
Get rid of that one. John Strom, Frida Love Smith, Juliana Hatfield in studio, Blake Babies celebrating their 30th anniversary, the band that College Rock. Yeah, isn't it? I mean, it's that's sort of the peg,
it is,
right?
The anniversary, yes.
It's the anniversary.
We 30 years ago today.
A Boston-based college rock band, which is sort of the, before we call it indie rock, it's college rock, that really, I mean, just an amazing amount of work in such a short amount of time. The band broke up in 1991, after 4 years together. They're back together in a limited way. This isn't really like a reunion tour. You guys are kind of selectively picking different places to play intimate shows, really on the fact that the demos are being released for Earwig.
Well, that was we talked a little bit about the Pledge campaign earlier. So, and this is something I was trying to see what we could get away with Juliana before she's great uncle, you know. So it's like, we could play a couple shows, right? And so we kind of snuck them into the Pledge package. And the idea behind these shows, which we've been true to, is that they would be a very limited number of shows and very limited attendance, you know. And it's kind of a high ticket price because we wanted to keep it, you know, just real fans who are really excited to be there. And that was definitely the vibe in Boston or Somerville when we played. It was people who were really, really psyched to be there, which made it way more special.
But they get extra special things. Like, we're not, it yes. makes it, that almost sounds like we're exploiting, because there's the biggest fans, we're going to charge more money.
No, that's, I mean, not, it's,
we included not, a so copy
we,
of the
we
record.
We gave them more things. Yeah, there's more of an experience with the band.
Well, you guys are taking a crowdsource approach, which I mean, every single act that I have on the show seems to be doing this kind of thing where there is this direct one-to-one with your audience now. You don't have to go through labels. You don't have to get radio play. You don't have to get on TV. You can go one-to-one, and Blake Babies seems to be a perfect project for that kind of thing because you do have rabid fans that were interested in that band, interested in what you guys have done since, even here in Chicago. I mean, this is a Blake Babies town.
And we're giving them a lot of value for that. You know, it's like we're charging what we have to charge to make it work financially because, you know, it is a small crowd and we're traveling and you know, we met everybody personally. We did a Q&A afterwards. You know, we signed every big stacks of stuff people brought. You know, which is strange for me because I work with artists and it's been a long time since I've been on that side of the table. But it was cool because our fans are really cool.
Just wait till some girl asks you to sign her boob.
Oh, it's happened. I was in the Lemon Hits, Julia.
Well, as we have about 5 minutes left here, and I really want to get, if you guys will indulge me, to be introspective about your careers. I mean, you guys have, I mean, we talk about the 30th anniversary. You know, you started off and you talked about the idea of wanting to be in a band, and that's it. You wanted to, that was the idea. There wasn't this ambition to be rock stars in the way that, you know, that was available in 1986. You know, you didn't want to be Paula Abdul. So why don't we start, we'll go around the table. John, for you, your life, you are an entertainment lawyer in Nashville. You wrote an article which was really interesting about the idea of music now being a hobby.
Right, right.
But talk about that. Talk about where you're at now and the fact that you as a musician, a guy who was in the Blake Babies, Lemonheads, Antenna, these bands down the line now, you know, rarely pick up the guitar.
I pick up the guitar all the time. I've been through periods where I didn't play much. But that article that I wrote, which is thetalkhouse.com, I thought was important because I think not enough people embrace music as a hobby. People feel like they have to be ambitious and have to do something with it and have to be public about it. And, you know, music is joyous. That's why I got into doing it. And one thing I realized, because my entertainment law career is really working with musicians. I really almost exclusively work with artists, helping them with their careers. And I realized that what I enjoy doing is exactly what I enjoyed most about being in the Blake Babies, which was the kind of project aspect of it, you know. We're building something, you know, how do we do this? How do we get a gig? And you know, how do we record? Those sorts of things, which were really challenges that we had to figure out, you know, one thing at a time. And that's very much like what I do now for my clients. So, you know, I'm still doing most of what I loved about that. And then I'm playing all the time, which is what I loved about, you know, playing music, right?
So when you look at, I mean, we talked to the John Strom of Blake Babies back in 1988 and say, when you get older, you'll be an entertainment lawyer.
I mean, I think I would have thought that it was just a total disaster. You know, it's like I'm a suburban dad and I'm a lawyer. What? I'm not that guy, you know, but it's great. I love my life. And so much of what we did and what I learned back then I apply to my life now, which is great.
Frida, all right, for all you, right. I mean, we talked a lot about this already with the memoir when you came in,
we did.
Just about the idea of, you know, thinking back now to the days of Blake Babies, you know, now as we've now decided to peg his 30-year anniversary. What role does music play in your life? And more importantly, when you think of those times, you know, talk about what it means to you to have been a part of this band.
So music has moved in and out of my life, but it's one of those things that has always come back. I actually had 8 years where I didn't play at all, but now I'm playing a lot, and it feels great to be able to come at it from where I'm at now in my life. With like I really appreciate it in a way that I think when I look back on those 30 years ago, that maybe I was looking a little bit more like, what can music do for me and what can I get out of this? And I feel opposite of that now. Like, it feels so lucky to me to be able to be doing it, especially to be playing with John and Julianne again, to kind of have another chance to play with them. So I feel kind of older, wiser, and more grateful. And also, I think I thought, like, when I was older, I wouldn't be playing music. I think I drew stricter categories on different phases of my life when I was younger. And now I just feel kind of open-minded to be surprised by it and to just see where it takes me.
Julianne Hatfield. You've had a life in which you've been a musician. I mean, you have gone further in ambition. You've been a pop star. You continue to tour. You continue to create new works and continue to be a working touring musician. Talk about that time, what it means to you, the Blake Babies, and also about what music means to you.
The Blake Babies was really, such a cherished and important time in my life. It was my first real band, and it was the start of everything for me. You know, it was the start of a lot of my dreams eventually coming true, and that was the beginning of it. You know, when I first met John and Frida and we went and we jammed in their apartment on that first night when we first met, I felt like my dream is literally coming true. And then, you know, other of my dreams came true after that, you know, like having a song on the radio, here going into a new city on tour and turning on the radio in the car and hearing my song, and it was just like, this is my dream come true, meeting a bunch of my heroes. And but I also feel I feel this bittersweetness when I think about it all, because I'm still frustrated, and I feel like I don't know. I feel I'm allowing myself finally at this period of my life to, you know, think about. I've always been very stoic about everything, but now I'm allowing myself to think, like, why did, you know, that one period a long time ago get so much attention and nothing else that I've done since then? Mm-hmm. And because I've never stopped making music. And it's strange to think that this period of a few years of my life was the period that got so much attention. And then I guess that's just what happens, though. You know, like, that happens to everybody.
Not Neil Young.
Yeah. Not when you're young.
But right? I mean, there's one something is sort of more beloved than I don't really know what I'm trying to say.
I think I make sense. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I'm not trying to get us all down in the room.
I mean, it's
30 years, and it's, as a fan of your music, and I speak for everybody who's a fan of your music, I mean, it is great that it's lasting, and you can hear the songs that we just played, or you can go on even the streaming services and put Blake Babies in, and here come all the songs and the stuff rushing back to you, and that's a testament to what you guys have accomplished. John Strom, Frida Love Smith, Julianna Hatfield. They're playing at Space in Evanston. Tickets will be available at that show.
Yeah, you can get the full package through Pledge, and for a somewhat lower ticket price, I think it's $50. You can go just
to the door
for the show.
It's daytime, so it's Saturday at 1:00.
It's 1 o'clock doors. Open, yeah. We play promptly at 1:30. It'll all be over by 3:30. There's going to be we're going to play a long set Q&A and try to meet everybody, and it's going to be good fun.
And the demo, the Earwig demo, is a part of the Pledge Now campaign. You can find that if you go to Pledge Music.
PledgeMusic.com. You can find it easily. And yeah, I mean, eventually they'll be widely distributed, but for now, that's the only place you can get it.
Can
I say one more thing? Mm-hmm. I feel like I just brought everything down.
No,
I don't know what, know what I just said, but what I really want to end with is I'm so extremely proud of the work that we did as the Blake Babies. I'm so proud of all of it.
All right. There
Amen.
You go.
Nice.
Juliana, John, Frida, thanks for being here. Thanks for being my guest.
Thank you
so
much.
Thanks, Justin.